Among Books is a show where we talk about reading and more. It's recorded in person at Hilltop Books in Northwest Philadelphia. I'm Stephanie Marudis of Kuvenda Media, and on this episode, I chat with Marlene Patterson and Nadine Patterson. They are mother and daughter, and together they run a film production company. It's called HIP Cinema, which stands for Harmony Image Production Cinema. For more about Marlene Patterson and Nadine Patterson, please check out the show notes, where you'll also find a reading list based on our conversation. Welcome, Marlene Patterson and Nadine Patterson, to Among Books.
We are happy to be here, Among Books.
Well, I'm so glad that you both could join us, and this is going to be a real treat. You are mother and daughter, who I understand both love reading and are collaborators too in other ways, which we will find out about. As you look around here, I wonder if there are any books that have jumped out at you.
Well, the books about the focus on Philadelphia neighborhoods, I see Strawberry Mansion. There's probably a Chestnut Hill one here somewhere that I just haven't spotted yet. And Philadelphia is such a wonderful city of neighborhoods. They're great stories.
Indeed.
I just love the ambiance of being surrounded by books. Whenever I'm in a place with lots of books on bookshelves, I just feel very comfortable and just very warm and welcome to a space. And I saw the autobiography of Will Smith coming in, and also looking at the books about visual arts and photography and artwork and sculpture caught my eye as well.
Yeah, you mentioned, you know, a sense of calmness of being around books. Tell me about that, because I know you are a lifelong reader.
You know, ever since I can remember, just growing up on 16th Street in North Philly, Nicetown, Tioga, our home just had an abundance of books. I lived with my mom and with her parents, my grandparents, Mr. and Mrs. Green, and books were everywhere. So as a child, I could just take a book off the shelf. It didn't matter that I might not have understood any of it, you know, something by Cervantes, you know, or Pearl S. Buck. There was just always a diversity of books in the house and just always a very multicultural view of the world through books in our home growing up. And of course, having books about Black history and about Martin Luther King and some of his speeches and his writings was just always very powerful.
I wonder for you, Mrs. Patterson, how you cultivated that reading environment and where that came from, because here Nadine is sharing that you really had a library in your house, is what it sounds like.
Yes. So it was the home in which I grew up. So it was cultivated by my parents. So my mother loved reading. So there were books of all sizes. There were little books. There were big books. There were heavy books. There were books of art, so that you could engage with some of these books before you were a reader. Certainly you were a looker. And just enjoy looking at them or the weight of them and discovering them. And then, of course, books were given as gifts. So I had my own little age-appropriate books, I guess, from an early age, or books that people thought were age-appropriate. It's interesting to reflect on the question, like, what was it like? And then, because there was radio, that also encouraged reading. So you'd listen to the radio and the words and the stories and be encouraged to think about reading or maybe even writing little stories.
Can you each remember some of the earliest books you might have been introduced to?
What I remember my mother reading to me Dr. Seuss stories, bedtime stories. So that was my first recollection of literacy, of someone reading to me. And then I would look at the pages. I would see the illustrations of the story. I would see the words and the letters. And the repetition is what really started me on the path of appreciating poetry, you know. I will not eat them, Sam I am. I will not eat green eggs and ham. I will not eat them here or there. I will not eat them anywhere. I will not eat them in a boat. I will not eat them. And just, oh, no, no, no. You know, so that got me hooked on stories. And I wanted to learn how to do that for myself. I could read other people's stories, and then I can write stories and have other people read my stories. That, to me, was such a wonderful thing, and I had such a sense of accomplishment as a little person. So I started journaling when I was 5 or 6, and I remember getting this little brown journal with the black tape spine and the little thin blue lines and writing. It was the best thing. So I would always come home and just go to the encyclopedia and look up things, and I might copy things and take notes. And so to this day, when I read, I also write. So I'm currently working on a script about the great inventor Lewis Latimer. So I'm reading a book about Latimer called Lewis Latimer, the First Hidden Figure, and it's by Steve Mitnick. And so as I'm reading this ebook, I'm also taking notes in a big journal now. You know, I will show it to you, Stephanie. Mm-hmm. But I'm always like reading and writing and reading and writing, and it goes hand in hand.
So this environment that you grew up in, you know, was ripe for you to just like soak up the written word, to produce the written word, and you're a writer, you're, you know, a storyteller, you're a producer, filmmaker.
Yeah, I mean, when I was a child, I wanted to be a scientist. So part of my writing was taking notes. So my mother ordered for me, I would get the Popular Mechanics magazine. And so I would read that, and I would read about the scientific process. And so growing up, I loved plants. And, you know, I had plants in the house. I would give them names and I would chart their growth. I was always taking notes of things. So for me, it wasn't just about telling stories. It was about documenting our world. So it just happened to fall into what I do as an adult.
I can't recall early that age memories of reading or writing, really, until I was like 11 or 12 or so.
Yeah, how about then? Maybe those middle grade years.
Right, so I loved Nancy Drew, for instance, yeah. And so some of them were books that my mother had and had read, so they were not books aimed at the preteen market or anything. As I got older and I learned that there certainly was a big market there and a lot to read, but so I went for the big thick books that didn't have to have illustrations, and I was a big fan of Nancy Drew, and that was around. And then history of famous black people or well-known black people, and George Washington Carver and his creativity and that kind of thing. But I loved reading, you know, whether it was magazines or books around the house. And then, of course, by the time I was 9, 10, or 11, I guess I could go to the library. And I wanted to read my way around the library. The children's room was a large room, but one that in its size was kind of challenging to the thought that you could read your way around the whole large square room. And I loved the Oz books. I particularly remember those. And that was the time when there was not a market of books on subjects of African-American history or children or adults or families. So that was not really out there to read or to pursue or to discover, really. But of course, as I said, some history of a few black people might be available. And later, I guess I made a point of wanting to read more African-American history as individual biographies and so on.
So as an adolescent, young preteen, you were noticing the absence of those books and stories.
Yeah. So how do you say the absence was notable. Mm-hmm. Was notable. But of course, there were the efforts within the Black community to pass on this history in community spaces, whether it was churches or whether it was organizations within the community.
So when she became a young parent, she made sure that her daughter had plenty to read. And one of the books, series, comic books, was called Golden Legacy. And she got me, I don't know, maybe a dozen of these. I love them because it was visual, educational, and I got to read, and I could try to draw things that I saw. It's a graphic novel. These are graphic magazines. One of them was about Lewis Latimer.
Oh, wow.
And so that image and that story just stuck in my mind. You know, for me, growing up, the best thing was like books about Black history so I could see myself and I could imagine myself in the world. And then also seeing Star Trek and seeing Nichelle Nichols playing Lieutenant Uhura. So for me, the image that I had of Black people in science was Lieutenant Uhura on Star Trek on the bridge of the USS Enterprise and Lewis Latimer, the inventor of the long-lasting carbon filament and the technical draftsman who worked with Alexander Graham Bell in designing the telephone. So these images, whether it's a comic book or a television show, you know, if it's a book, you can hold it and study it and carry it with you. You can make notes. It's just so important for little people to have our history in a book because it's nothing so disheartening as going into a space, whether it's a museum or a library, and only seeing books about white people, mm-hmm. about European heritage, Irish, Russian, German, Italian. And it's like, well, I know my people did things, but I don't see the evidence. And certainly in school, by the time I got to fifth grade, school didn't counter that balance. My mother enrolled me at the Ivy League school, which was a Black-owned and administered school. It was K through fourth grade, and I only went there 1 year. And before, I attended a primarily white school, and it was great because I got to run around outside. I learned how to make pottery and do different things. But then when it came to third grade, my reading lagged behind my peers. And I love reading. I love books. But my teacher wasn't paying me any attention. She wasn't nurturing. She wasn't encouraging. Told my mom, well, Nadine has no interest in reading. Mm. And she knew that was a lie. Half the time, I was in books or writing. I love that. That was my passion. So she knew she had to get me out of that environment quick, fast, and in a hurry. Right? So going to Ivy Leaf, I had a private tutor, Mrs. Parrott. We met two or three times a week after school, and my reading improved. I went through three different reading levels in 1 year to the point where I was then ready to enter Masterman. I excelled at Masterman. And all because I was nurtured in a Black environment where there were books about my culture. There were science books that had figures in it that looked like me. There were teachers that looked like me. People who said, yes, you can do whatever you imagine. You can do it. Let's work on these things together. It is possible. So from my experience having a library, so that library that my mom went to was expansive in Nicetown, Tioga. The one I went to was tiny. I think it was it a third of the size or a fourth of the size of your library? Now, I love that library because one of my favorite people was there, Mrs. Bertha, the librarian. And we had a lifelong friendship, as it turned out. But, you know, when I was 5, 6, 7, she was my favorite librarian. When we moved to Germantown, then I started hanging out at the Northwest Regional Branch mm-hmm. at Green and Shelton. Mm-hmm. That library, that was my library. Mm. The funny thing is, I didn't hang out in the kids section. I was in the adult section upstairs. I loved the magazine room. That was my favorite place. All the scientific and astronomy magazines were there, magazines about computers and cars and architecture, everything. And my favorite section in that library was the science fiction section. So I would take out books by Isaac Asimov, Ray Bradbury, and that's where I discovered Octavia Butler. Mm. And I just loved reading her books. But that library, that was like heaven to me. And all the scientific books and all the sci-fi books I could imagine were there. So I didn't have the thought of reading every single book in the library, but I did have the thought of reading as much science fiction as I could.
So the ability to go upstairs to the adult section was huge for
yes.
you.
Yes, yeah. And that was when I was like 11, 12, 13. Yeah. So I just never went to the kids section.
Just curious what both of you might be reading these days.
I'm reading the memoir by Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson, and I'm finding it just delightful. So I'm really enjoying that. And I'm also reading a book written some years ago, Proud Shoes. It's a memoir of a African-American woman. It's a memoir that looks at her family history, and you wonder, how did she...
Oh, Pauli Murray.
Pauli Murray, yes. How does she get all these details? How does a writer go about putting together a family history that starts off with the world through the eyes of her grandfather who fought in the Civil War, as he describes the Civil War battles that he witnessed and the people who had been loosed from the plantations who were on the road and struggling to make a way to freedom. It's just a beautiful description. This is the world through the eyes of her grandfather, up through the eyes of her grandmother, and then her own experience as a civil rights attorney, a legal scholar, a very productive person. But it's the fascinating question of how can people know this, how to write about it? How do they find the data to put it together to make a credible, readable, and fairly accurate story? So that's looking at it from the perspective of the storyteller, you know, like how does one do that? How does one enrich with sufficient detail, accurate details, you know, and tell a realistic story about an era where so little information is available and we want to know. Mm. So we appreciate what's been done and we are inspired to go and find similar stories that we can embellish upon and present to the world, the hidden stories, the hidden figures, so to speak, the things that are there.
Telling the untold story.
The untold story.
I'm currently reading a book that is about writing because I'm obsessed, but also it's about crafts. So it's called The Short, Writing Tools to Free the Imagination. And it's by a filmmaker who's from Philadelphia named Ray Shaw. And even though the book technically is about creating scripts for the short film genre, it also is helpful if you're creating a music video, a TV commercial, a video game, or a feature film or television series. What Ray talks about is the importance of building a world. So what are the elements? So one thing that she talks about is something as simple as how do people communicate? Every era has a certain way of communicating. So in our modern era, it's the cell phone, right? But in 1890, how do people communicate? There was a telegraph. Before the telephone was commonly used, there was a telegraph. People wrote letters. They wrote letters in pencil, in pen. What kind of pens? You know? And I read something in Ray's book. She mentioned that. And the ink pen has been around since the Egyptians. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, okay, now my mind is blown, right? You know, so here's a book that's clearly written by someone with an Afrocentric point of view, which I can appreciate again. So I'm immersed in her world, but her world reflects who I am and reflects my ancestry in a way that she can tie inventions going back thousands of years and bring it to the present. And I think one thing that we have to do as African Americans is talk to our elders more. Talk to them, learn from them. Don't shut them away in a nursing facility, because there's so much knowledge. You know, they say once a person dies, it's like a whole library passes with them, right? I forget who said that, but it's true. They're not just a book. That person contains a whole library of experiences. So we need to talk to our elders more and record them more, or just write down their stories. You know, my mother started writing about her recollections of her ancestors, and also creating fiction stories about what might have been, about freed African Americans living in Maryland in the mid-1800s and what that must have been like, you know, or what it was like raising a family of 11 kids, you know, what it was like, you know, driving a Model T for the first time. You know, that was the story of my grandfather, her father, driving the salesman back to the dealership after his father purchased their first car. So all these are stories that we need to document and pass on.
We're going to take a short break now from our conversation and turn it over to Amy Wilson. She's the executive director of the Friends of the Chestnut Hill Library and manager at Hilltop Books, where we record the show.
We're a used bookstore run on book donations, so it's volunteer staffed, open 6 days a week, and it's run by the Friends of the Chestnut Hill Library. All of the books in the store are just a third of the retail price on the book. Proceeds from our sales benefit the Chestnut Hill Library. So we support programs at the library, we support the book collections, and we also help out with building maintenance and advocate for the library system as a whole. We love volunteers. There's a range of volunteer opportunities, from working in the store to helping us with pop-ups and special events. And our volunteer intake form is on our website.
For more about Hilltop's hours, location, and volunteer opportunities, log on to hilltopbooks.org. And come join us at the bookstore for a party to celebrate Among Books on Saturday, October 11th. From 3 to 5 p.m. Get a chance to chat with some of the people featured on the podcast, including Pennsylvania State Senator Art Haywood. Refreshments and light snacks will be served. And if you like walking and hearing scary stories, don't miss a very special ghost walk with Hilltop Books on Saturday, October 18th. Live storytellers will be sharing tales along a short route from the Chestnut Hill Library to the bookstore. For more details and to sign up, log on to hilltopbooks.org and click on events. Now, back to our conversation.
I'm always trying to improve my craft, so that's why I'm reading the short right now, to improve my craft as we polish the screenplay. So the screenplay is done, but it's never just, you just don't stop with one draft. You know, we've done two drafts of our Latimer script, and we're working on a third draft now.
Well, tell us more about it. We'd love to hear.
So Reclaiming the Light, The Life and Times of Lewis Latimer looks at a community of people after the Civil War, after enslavement, during the years of Reconstruction and Jim Crow, where African Americans basically walked off the plantation with nothing except their experiences. They were traveling the countryside looking for family members and reconnecting. And Latimer's heritage, he is the son of runaways. His parents escaped slavery in Virginia, escaped to Boston, Massachusetts. And his father was recaptured 4 days later, unfortunately. And so there was a big trial, and they ended up, the abolitionists, the white and black abolitionists in Boston at the time, ended up having to buy his freedom. So that's the experience that Latimer comes out of. But the film at its heart is about him as a self-taught electrical engineer, right?
Which is unbelievable.
He taught himself these skills. He was a teenager who enlisted in the Navy during the Civil War at the age of 15. So they lied about his age, right? But he was passionate, again, because he grew up in an abolitionist family mm-hmm. in that environment. His brothers also served in the Civil War. So he's patriotic. He believes in the Constitution. You know, he only was educated formally up to the fifth grade, but he had a passion for books and for learning. He was a paper boy. He sold newspapers. Mm-hmm. He must have been an obsessive reader. He taught himself French and German, Latin and Greek. Again, an obsessive reader.
A Renaissance man.
A Renaissance man.
He became an apprentice. This job he got at this, was it?
It was at a patent law firm, basically.
Now, fortunately, he gets this little job. You know, you usually at 15, 16 end up sweeping the floor or something like that. But he was in a place where he could learn as he did whatever the jobs were that were assigned to him. And learn he did. So when we say self-taught, it was with the help of people around him. But he must have brought so much to the table that people wanted to encourage and teach this young man who they see has all these very talents, you know? Yeah. So when we say self-taught, not formal school, there he was on the job.
He was self-taught in that he observed the owners of the firm drawing. And then he said, can I try that? And first of all, they were shocked that he could just observe what they were doing and think that he could do it. They're like, okay, sure, go ahead, try. Ha, ha, ha. They're like, snap, you can really do it. Okay, here's more.
Yeah.
Right. But he was encouraged by members of the abolitionist movement who knew his father growing up in Boston. So he was encouraged by them.
Mm. Yeah. And when we talked on the phone to set up this conversation, you were telling me also about his wife.
Yes.
Mary Latimer.
Mary Latimer. Yes. She was a seamstress. So we're still trying to find more research about her. So what we noticed in one of his patents, she was a assigned witness. So in their relationship, she must have had an interest in science. Mm-hmm. You know, she traveled with him when he worked for Hiram Maxim. She traveled with him to London and lived there for a year. So she had an interest in what he was doing. She had an interest in learning. And the fiction part of the film, the conceit is that she is a seamstress. She was a seamstress. That's on the census documentation. But that she worked from her home. So she would have guests come in, you know, look at her wares, or she would create clothing for them, dresses, coats, or she would repurpose coats and material for people in like a salon type setting. And another part of that, in terms of like having the salon and having trying on of clothes, having teas, is also reading books, reciting poetry. We know that Latimer was a poet himself. He wrote poetry and he wrote plays. And they had soirees at their homes up until in their 70s and 80s, right? So he lived to be 80 years old. He died in 1928 and he was born in 1848. So like he spans, they both span a time of history in which Black people go from being enslaved in 1848 to being free, 1865, to bursting on the scene, creating all kinds of amazing inventions. It wasn't just Latimer. It was Granville T. Woods. It was the real McCoy. It was just all these Black Americans, men and women, who held patents. After 1870, it became legal for Black Americans to actually patent their inventions. Before, they couldn't patent their work, and it was appropriated by other people who were not Black. So we know this is part of our history. So the fact that between 1870 and 1900 was the greatest era of patents that were filed for Black Americans is astounding.
Yeah.
Is astounding. And Latimer is part of that story. He had patents that dealt with electric light that were just foundational.
This is so exciting. And your film production company, it's called Hip Cinema. And what's striking is that the two of you run it. How did that come to be?
So I just want to say that HIP Cinema stands for Harmony Image Productions. cinema, so HIP. And Harmony was my mom's idea in terms of the name. So you want to talk about the name of the company?
Yes, I'm trying to recall. I liked the idea, the concept of Harmony. And also it goes back to our roots with our family from a section of Maryland, a small town called Harmony, Maryland. So that's why I was attracted to Harmony.
And when did you two officially come together to collaborate?
So that would have been back in the late 1980s.
Okay, yeah. This has been a long-running collaboration.
Yeah, it's not easy being an independent filmmaker. No, you know, it takes a long while to get projects together, financed, finished, and so on. So yeah, back and then at that point, Nadine had announced her career choice that she wanted to be a filmmaker. And everybody said, well, you've got to make some films if you want to have a career as a filmmaker.
I can say it's a lot of fun, actually. She's the producer. I'm the director. And we've always respected each other's position on set and our perspectives and opinions. Mm-hmm. So, for example, I was working on a script for Tango Macbeth. And she was very honest. It's like, oh, this isn't really working. She said, oh, you need some help with this. You know, and just like with this script, it's like, it's not there yet. You know, it's like, keep working at it. Mm-hmm. And then she will actually have not suggestions about how she would tell the story, but just say, well, you have to be more specific about what's happening in this time period, like be clear on the context and how does that context show up in your story, for example, so that the critique isn't someone injecting their creative point of view, but she really is that first audience member who can look at a script outline, look at a script or look at a rough cut, then give a critique, which is helpful.
Before we get to the final question, Nadine had told me on the phone when we were setting up the conversation that you, Mrs. Patterson, had set up a reading group around the time Nadine was maybe 11 or 12 with some other writers.
The first writers group was a group of writers that allowed us to participate, to encourage us to write and feel comfortable with writing, although it contained people who had written and published real books, you know, one books for children, another a book general adult population, and the other person, I'm not sure. So those are the people who were the published, working, paid writers, plus other people, friends who write and wanted to get stuff published, I guess, and friends who just wanted to be in an encouraging writing environment. That was us.
Oh,
yeah. Right.
So the reading, we would be reading each other's work.
I see.
That's the reading.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
The fact that, you know, Kirsten Hunter, Muriel Feelings, and other grown adult Black women would be reading a short story, sci-fi story that Nadine Patterson wrote.
At age?
At 11.
11.
At age 11, right? At age 11. So you read the story. So you read your story and they listen to you reading. That was so cool.
How
that
formative.
That was the best. So it was a writing group, but you read and you listened and you wrote. So again, for me, it was like one feeds the other constantly. Uh-huh. So the second group, I think this came about 10 years later. I was 21, out of college. And we started reading Beloved, Toni Morrison's Beloved, The Salt Eaters by Toni K. Bambara. We might have read Octavia Butler's Kindred. That was mind-blowing.
Because these works were mind-blowing. You know, really.
And when I saw pamphlet, Scribe Video Center, screenwriting, instructor, Toni K. Bambara.
Oh, wow.
I flipped out. I was like, fangirling, I'm like, oh my God, oh my gosh, oh my gosh. So I signed up. I called, signed up, spoke with another awesome writer, Emiko Tanoka, a Japanese-American photographer and writer. And that's how I got hooked on Scribe, you know, because Tony K. Bambara was there teaching screenwriting. And then my mother took a screenwriting course with Tony Cade a year later for the Anna Russell Jones project. Yeah. So to actually be in a writing class for film with a novelist whose work you have read was amazing.
Amazing.
So one thing in the Latimer film was that both Mary Latimer and Lewis Latimer kept a journal, and they were both avid readers. And in the film, Mary Latimer will have a women's book club group. And this is going to be patterned after the Aurora Reading Group, which is a real women's club that was established in 1894 in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. And so part of our creative conceit is to create a writing club for Mary Latimer so that they can have discussions about the issues of the day, read and write poetry and prose, and really show the intellectual life of women at that time. And then also show how proud husbands like Latimer would occasionally pop into the reading group and read poetry or perform the flute or sing a song and entertain the ladies.
When you had mentioned that too on the phone about the history of Black women's reading groups, I was just doing a little research and I brought this for you. You might already have seen this, but I had found that Philadelphia, even going back to the 1830s, had three Black women literary societies. And it was all part of sort of the abolitionist.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so that's for you. We'll rip it off afterwards. Oh. But as you can see there, this isn't a chapter from a book about, you know, the abolitionist movement.
You know, liberation, education, literacy, it goes hand in hand. It goes hand in hand. And that's why it was illegal for African Americans to have the tools to read and to write. It was illegal. But if you want to write a patent, you have to be able to read and write and run a printing press and and get yourself out there. But yeah, I mean, I just want to share the stats. In 1870, 79-80% of the Black community was illiterate. We know why. It was illegal. Mm-hmm. But by 1910, 30% of the African-American community was illiterate. That means a 40% swing, almost 40% swing, right? How did they do that? Reading groups, literary societies, churches, one-room schoolhouses, evening schools, settlement houses, all these things the Latimers were involved in.
Well, we're going to look forward to your film and wishing you all the best with the continued production and writing. Before we wrap up our time here, you know, the big question that we're asking everyone on this podcast are, you know, what might be some of the books that have had profound influences on you that maybe have shaped the way that you think and act or live in this world?
Well, that's a deep question. Let me think a minute more.
Of course, yeah.
I think I have to say Green Eggs and Ham. I go back to Dr. Seuss because growing up, I was a very particular child. I didn't like to eat most things. I didn't want to try things. And as an adult, I now eat things that I didn't like as a little person. And the whole idea of a story where someone learns to appreciate new experiences and learns how to make friends through those experiences is just very profound. And the fact that my mother actually made Green Eggs and Ham for me one day also was like bringing a book to life.
Oh.
So that has had a tremendous impact in terms of a book. And I actually purchased a copy of that when I was in London at London Film School in 2003 or 2004, just as a kind of a comfort book to read for myself. So,
as I said, the Pauli Murray book, actually looking at the family history and covering a period and telling a story. And so in recent years, that really has had an impact as I think about how we want to tell stories and just marvel at how people write stories, and even if it's not a book, even if it's just a shorter piece, there's a lot to be learned from that and inspired by that, and more I want to know about the stories that weren't told, and maybe we can dig out and research and find.
Well, thank you for being with us here. It's been a true pleasure, and it's inspiring to have this conversation with you because, you know, you both live and breathe reading and writing, and I just want to thank you so much.
Well, thank you. It's our pleasure.
Thank you.
Among Books is mixed by Brad Linder and produced by me, Stephanie Marutis of Kuvenda Media. And a final special thanks to the Friends of the Chestnut Hill Library, its executive director and Hilltop Books manager, Amy Wilson, and the many volunteers who make the day-to-day operation of the bookstore possible. Until next time, happy reading.